Hello, in this episode of AS for Architecture, Ashton Ham, founder and principal of UXO Architects, a worker-owned practice, a cooperative no less, based in Oakland, California, talks to me about her work, principles and practice, and her recent book, Practice Practice, edited by Peggy Diemer and Dariel Cobb, and published by Oro Editions in 2023.
A is for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Ashton Ham. Ashton, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself, because you'll do a better job than I can. And also pronounce the name of your architecture practice so that I don't have to make a mistake.
Sure. My name is Ashton Ham. I am an architect with UXO Architects, and I am located in Northern California.
And that's it. That's the most straightforward introduction. You definitely are not an academic, because that would go on for quite a long time usually. So it's just UXO. It's not UZO. It's not UXO.
We get a lot of that, but nope, it's just UXO.
What does the UXO stand for?
I think it actively does not stand for anything. You know, I think that we kind of were born in a time where everyone was putting together a bunch of last names and coming up with three-letter last names. And I think this is very actively against that, because we're not anyone's firm. We are kind of everyone's firm who we're working with.
Ah, okay. Now that's good. So we're going to be talking about your book, Practice Practice, which you've published with Oro. And it's a lovely short book about the nature of cooperative practice. And maybe we can get to that. How did you get into architecture? Do you come from an architecture background? Where did you study? And how have you ended up at this point of kind of pursuing what I pick up from the book as being a fairly radical approach to being an architect in the States?
Yeah, thanks. So yeah, I studied architecture at Virginia Tech. I have a bachelor's in architecture. In the US, I'll just lay this out, but there's a few paths. You can get a bachelor's of architecture, or you can kind of get a master's, whether or not you studied architecture in undergrad. And so I went the five-year path and got a bachelor's of architecture. I never really anticipated when I was in undergrad that I would be advocating state legislators in California to change like a very niche component of the Business and Professions Code. But here I am. I think that my path to being a cooperative is really kind of a path of, you know, working collectively with friends through architecture school at Virginia Tech. You know, that the pedagogy of Virginia Tech is really rooted in the Bauhaus, which is like incredibly collaborative in nature. And I think that was really reflected in how I was working and co-working with some of my friends and during my time there. And when I came out into the profession, I kind of saw what the reality of practice was, because in school we were, you know, in this bubble of academia and didn't really have the awareness of really what practice was going to be like. And in some ways, it was just very eye-opening to see myself and my colleagues kind of struggle with what happened to be this kind of top-down approach to the profession. And so not that far into, you know, being in practice, I decided, you know, I think I want to try to do this on my own and see. And so I, you know, invited one of those colleagues from Virginia Tech. And we, you know, I kind of started taking small projects and got some momentum there, and then eventually invited one of those colleagues from Virginia Tech. And, you know, we started a cooperative. And I think it really, again, was just like, we want to make decisions together collectively and democratically and, you know, kind of see how things will go from there.
So when did you graduate? Did you graduate into the middle of the financial crisis post 2008?
No, I graduated in 2014.
I still think we live in the tail of that. And you mentioned this in the beginning of the book as a kind of critical moment. And then you also mentioned this other side of architectural practice. And I don't really know much about architectural practice in the States, but from where we are, I think practice and the practice of architects remains very mysterious to the general public. Is that kind of how it is over your way?
Absolutely. And I would say even more so to the general public here, because there's quite a bit of work you can do without a licensed architect or without an architect at all in the US. You can build, you know, to a certain extent of homes and, you know, enough remodels. Contractors can do a lot of that work. And so, you know, we enter into contracts with folks, and they really have no idea what we do, what our job entails, and why they should pay us.
And is there a fee scale associated? You know, in Britain until reasonably recently, there was an expected fee scale that people could rely on. How does it work? Is it a very competitive market?
It's incredibly competitive. There was a fee set by the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, but that kind of went under with the Justice Department. The years are blanking in my mind right now, but
under Reagan's time,
then,
though,
I think it was a little after that, yeah. And so yeah, so then we, you know, no longer have kind of fixed fees, and it's really getting to the point now, I think, where we have these bigger firms which are taking a lot of the work from the smaller offices. However, there are so many small offices, and there's a bit of this kind of academic run, you know, boutique office that is kind of doing, you know, their labor from their students' work. So there's definitely some quote unquote suspect models of practice today.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I can see that. And I, particularly, as you say, with that quote unquote critical practitioners coming out of university and sweeping up quite a lot of important work, actually, without charging, sort of undercutting business-wise and taking jobs. So it's a mysterious one. Could you tell me a little bit about the origins of this book? Why did you decide to write this book about the way you were doing it? Was it simply that you want to promote the model?
Yes, actually, I don't consider myself a writer at all. This is like a very strange medium for me. And it was such a struggle to get it out into the world. But when we went to incorporate as a cooperative in the state of California back in 2017, I think it was, we were denied twice by the Secretary of State. And at that time, we had a really awesome attorney who kind of worked with us to figure out, well, what's going on. And what we learned during that process was that, again, this kind of very small component of the Business and Professions Code in the state of California essentially highlights this conflict between a licensed professional and how cooperative statutes are organized in the state. Now, it's further complicated by the fact that we have many different state statutes around cooperatives. And I think what became really evident to me during that time is like, wow, no one actually knows no one knows what's going on. We all kind of want to get the practice started. We use these defaults and, you know, just kind of never look back. And I think for us at the time, it was like, no, these defaults are things that we need to really have a critical eye on, because things aren't going well in the architectural practice for workers. And so kind of since going through that process of incorporation and kind of working with the attorney and finding a way to organize as a cooperative, people started reaching out to me. And, you know, I was having these meetings with folks, and it was kind of meeting after meeting of, you know, hey, it's possible, we can do it. And at the same time, the architecture lobby, I have to kind of, you know, talk about them, because they really planted the seed of the power of the cooperative model in the architectural practice. And so not only am I meeting with folks individually, but also in tandem with the architecture lobby, kind of what are the possibilities of the architectural model? And so I kind of felt like this information shouldn't just sit in my brain, and I don't have the capacity to kind of keep meeting with folks and having the same conversation over and over again. And I think that really, like, the intent here in writing this book was to show that there's not one way to practice a cooperative, and it's quite a complicated model, which, you know, each office is going to be very nuanced in how they apply some of these principles. But I really, you know, I don't want it to be like a gate-kept kind of phenomenon. It's very possible, but it just takes a little bit of work to kind of figure out how you can apply it to your office. So in some ways, I wanted this book to be general and specific enough and kind of cater to both more academic side and also students and also practitioners and also people looking to retire. So it was a bit of a strange project to kind of capture all of those audience and all of this like nuanced information while also being general enough. But this is the stab that I took.
It's really good. Maybe it would be good to sort of better understand. I don't want you to dwell on the problem of practice, but I'm assuming it's that people are overworked and underpaid and it's sort of unsustainable. And this lends itself to a certain form of building type in a weird kind of way, in that I guess it's a race to the bottom in terms of construction detailing and all the bits that sort of we should spend time thinking about, because it's in those gaps that we can make things beautiful but also and competent, but also ecologically sustainable, socially meaningful, so on and so forth. So it's the same story I think a lot of people have told me over the years I've been doing this. But why do, maybe if we can start with describing what a cooperative is as a model of business organization, and how you've gone about sort of applying it to the architectural practice model.
Yeah, so a cooperative is, you know, essentially allows for all employees to become owners, and that there's a very clear path towards ownership for any employee. And that all workers would participate in decisions about the firm, financial and not necessarily management, but kind of those kind of critical questions about the firm. So, you know, essentially like what project we're taking on, that kind of thing. Are we going to close, you know, next year, that kind of thing, salaries. And so for us, and this is very different, I think that this kind of transparency does not exist in kind of traditional practice. Right. I think, you know, most workers at larger firms really have no idea how the owners, you know, the amount of profit that the owners get at the end of the year. And I think there's really opaque steps to kind of getting, you know, going from staff to associate to whatever, you know, principal to all of those things. It's really a lot more discretionary, and kind of, you know, no one really knows what's going on. I think for us, the quote unquote radical idea is full transparency, of kind of all of these decisions of how we're running our business, of the finances, whether or not you're an owner. I think it's kind of, you should know about this. You should know how a practice is run, because we really see running the practice as a project in and of itself. You know, we take our bylaws very seriously, and each year we kind of spend a substantial amount of time reviewing them and working on them and saying, okay, what doesn't feel right? What does feel right? And how can we kind of move forward next year in good faith that we're going to kind of bring the best that we can? And I think a lot of this, you know, to think about, like, again, the opacity in larger firms, I think it's because corporations aren't required to have any sort of democratic organizing within them. You know, decisions can be made totally behind closed doors. And for us, we're opening all the doors and putting magnifying glasses on them.
That's quite an elegant idea, and it's very much of its time. I mean, that comes coming back to this idea of why this book now. I think that there is that appetite, isn't there? And architecture being such a Wild West kind of business. I mean, it is even over here. It's completely, I think it's mystifying to a lot of our international students when they finish up their undergraduate. Because the way that we run it here is we do 3 years undergraduate, then you go and work in practice for a year. And then you go back in for your master's. So it's an undergraduate and a master's. That's shifting now. And I think we're fairly close to adopting an American model, to be honest. I think that's where it's going. But they come in and they say, like, how do I get a job? And you're like, go get a job.
Yeah.
Try. I don't know. I mean, it's not very nice. And then they go into this world and it's peculiarly mysterious. And I do think we would benefit a huge amount from this level of transparency. How have you seen it? How has it compared to other practices you've been in terms of the ethos of the place that you're working? Do you feel like it has a distinct beneficial outcome, not just in terms of running the practice, but in terms of running a social organization, a cultural organization?
Yeah, I do. And I will say my practice in other firms is relatively limited, to be totally fair. You know, I started UXO not too deep into practice at all. But I will say that people come to us all of the time looking for a job because they say it's not working out here. You know, like we cannot find a job that aligns to our values ethically. And we think you're doing a really good job at this. And so I think that the model really caters to folks who want to play a part in ownership and want to kind of understand, like, you know, who just want to participate in kind of the practice of architecture in addition to the projects that we are doing. Mm-hmm. Which is quite different than, you know, just kind of clocking in, clocking out. And I will say, like, I don't want to say that in all cooperatives, everyone has to be like a very active owner. I think it's a big question of scale. You can have a large cooperative where people are really, they're still owners and benefit financially from that, but, and, you know, have some amount of ownership obligation. But, you know, I think you can still treat the work as a kind of clock in and clock out.
I really like this idea of actually treating the business of the business as a project in its own right. But before we started recording, you said you'd moved up from LA, maybe when we were recording, and you've moved up to Northern California, which is a very different animal to Southern California. It's a different country.
Yes.
Is that because cooperative life, cooperative business life is less attuned to the metropolitan center? Is it, would it be possible to run an effective co-op in the way that you wanted to in a city like LA? Or
I absolutely think it would be possible to run it there. You know, I think UXO was kind of birthed in the Bay Area, which is like one of the kind of most densely populated cooperative movements. And you know, we've been all over, we've been located all over the state of California, and we do projects all over the state of California. Mm-hmm. I think we're currently up here, you know, in part because I am no longer kind of in the place to be living in LA in this time of my life. And also the work that we're doing has really introduced me to this area. We're working with kind of some amazing tribal-led community land trusts here locally. And it felt really important to get closer to this large work that we're doing.
Are you in Arcata?
I sure am.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's an amazing part of the world. You are so fortunate. And I'm going to tell my wife about this afterwards, and she'll be really jealous. But I want to understand a little bit more about, you say an interesting point, and this is, strangely enough, I think the second time someone has said this to me in the last 3 weeks, about the relationship, and this was in relation to British architecture or practice, that architecture has maintained, in the way you put it, as a hands-off relationship with the labor movement. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think that for me, the kind of, again, I'm pretty young here, so I wasn't, you know, involved and around in the world during the Reagan era, but I know that there was quite a bit of kind of policy changes that had happened, or that happened there, but, mm-hmm. you know, very, very pro-corporate, pro-big business, and very anti-union, you know, all of that's coming out of Reagan's policy shifts. And I think it took a while for it to be felt in the architectural profession. But, you know, I think what that looks like now is like very like large corporations that kind of dominate the industry. And I think that additionally, there's several kind of examples of kind of architects shielding themselves from identifying as workers by identifying as professionals and kind of hiding under that. So I don't remember the date of this, but once upon a time, there were some workers at the Kohler factory who were not being treated fairly, and they kind of went to petition some architects and the AIA to kind of, hey, don't specify Kohler products because we don't, you know, we're not getting paid fairly at XYZ. And architects just totally took hands up, said, we have nothing to do with this. I think it's a huge missed opportunity for architects to stand in solidarity with kind of workers. But again, I think that we have this like kind of page around us historically as professionals. So we don't have to kind of engage and identify as such. And so that's kind of what I mean as this hands-off relationship. We can kind of shield by working in these large firms and you know, just not really engage as workers.
I see, because I was reading that the other way around and in thinking about the way that architecture itself is not a unionized profession, but coming back to what we were saying before, it's an incredibly laissez-faire and essentially a neoliberal kind of enterprise.
Yeah.
And perhaps that relates to its, I think in design school, one perhaps idealistically thinks that the role of the architect is that professional component. And I don't know, again, about the AIA ratification of the profession, but certainly in the UK, there is an obligation for the common good. That is absolutely critical to a professional identity. And so you kind of have this in your back of your mind, and then you go into practice and it's a jungle. But I think that's a really interesting other like your actual meaning to be thinking about our relationship with building makers. So are you saying that in a cooperative, because it's democratic, there's a stronger emphasis towards a more holistic well-being, a more holistic common good approach to architecture?
Absolutely. And I would say it's not only to architecture, but to the workers of the cooperative. You know, I think that for us, the like biggest and highest goal of the practice is to benefit the workers. So, you know, I think that looks like we really need to kind of get our heads together around what our kind of personal financial goals are, what and how can UXO help us meet that? What is our kind of like, I hate to use this term, but like work-life balance goals, and how can UXO help
us? You've lived in LA. You've definitely lived in LA. That's going to have to change in Humboldt County, that's for sure. No, go on.
Yeah, but you know, just like, I think that we are running the practice. And so how can our like human needs be met by being workers of this organization? And I think that's not an approach I think that a traditional practice really has.
How does UXO's cooperative operations operate? Do you start every week with a staff meeting to decide objectives? How do you write contracts? How is work divvied up? Is it distinct?
I would say it's distinct, but I just want to also really put it out there. It does not have to be. Cooperatives can look, they can kind of managerially look identical to kind of your more traditional practice. But for us, we've really, again, like we operate on a more horizontal dynamic. We do start every week with what we call tea time on Monday mornings. And we come together and kind of talk about all the projects that we have going on. I think, you know, we have different seasons of different projects, and we just got out of like a very intense moment. So, you know, this week we're kind of like, okay, we need to really kind of recover and check in on all of our other projects. But I think the way that we like to work is really like kind of everyone kind of coming together in all phases of the project. And, you know, there's obvious moments where that doesn't make sense and you have to kind of also do, you know, just kind of streamline and be kind of the one person doing the thing, but we're all kind of aware of what's going on. And I will say we also have a position where we kind of want to work on all phases of the project. We're not kind of in this position to have managers kind of over production staff. We are kind of project designers also doing the production work.
Sounds very good. Your work is very elegant. Have you found that there is a kind of aesthetic design impact on your identity as a cooperative? Do you feel like it inflects the design work in ways? Or, I mean, obviously you're designers and you do design, but do you feel like that discourse-based or that democratic kind of basis for your work is effective on design?
I want to say yes. I don't think we have enough empirical evidence to really like make that point. But I think that in some ways that is a huge like interest and kind of idea that I have. I don't know that there's enough architectural cooperatives to really produce that. I would say for us, it looks like the people that we are working with and our clients. And So we work with a lot of other cooperatives, nonprofits, and community land trusts kind of across the state of California. And we've really somehow, you know, we've also like broadened the work that we do. And I think this is actually is a little bit related to being organized as a cooperative, but we are also pretty involved in community engagement processes with the work that we're doing. So we've kind of led strategic visioning processes and different community engagement processes for various projects. And that's not that common for architects. You know, there's other consultants kind of brought on for those parts of projects. But I think some of our democratic organizing really supports that work and makes us feel like it's almost critical to the work that we're doing to bring the community into some of these like participatory design processes.
Yeah, and that's a very tricky animal, that one. I've done that. And from the perspective of being the architect or being, well, I'm not technically an architect. I just say that just in case I get sued for, I never took my professional papers, which I don't know if you have to do that in the States, but I never did that. I did a PhD instead, which was probably economically much worse for me. But anyway,
we do have exams that we have to take.
So you have to work in practice for a while afterwards and then you get to take exams about.
Yeah. So we have national exams and then we have a state exam if your state is one of the states that has a supplemental.
And California, I assume, does. Yeah.
Of course it does, yes.
Yeah. Other than Oregon, probably the most rule-based state. I don't know. I just felt in Oregon that I've never seen so much road signage. And I thought that's a bad sign. But there was a very famous architect in Britain called Edward Cullinan, Ted Cullinan. I always felt like that the aesthetic of their work was very much inflected by that idea. That not insofar as, you know, not insofar as the collaborative nature of the practice meant that they all sat around together with one pencil kind of trying to draw the buildings, but insofar as that it was an intention to make their work distinct such that people would see it and understand its relationship to this kind of ethical position which they had adopted, which I always thought was very lovely as a thing to do, because I think as architects we tend to make things look kind of cool, but if to try and make them look socially just, that's kind of it's an interesting intersection of ethics and aesthetics, which I quite enjoyed.
Absolutely. I mean, this is definitely such a rich area for exploration, and you know, I would there's a world in which, you know, I'm getting a PhD on that, which is never going to happen because I'm like very drawn to practice and just seeing how that plays out. So I think that there's so much kind of value in just seeing what happens. And I do believe that it is very possible. But I think we are so driven by, you know, how practice is set up here is really, it's really client-based. So I think, you know, we only can have so much control over what things will look like. And we're working with some amazing clients with some amazing ideas. So it's kind of just, we'll see, you know, at this point, I don't know, you know, we've been around since 2016, but which feels like kind of a long time at this point, but I feel like the body of work is only going to continue to develop. And I'm, you know, I think it's like looking back on that, you know, is that a thread that we can track through?
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. I asked a question in the notes I wrote to you only yesterday about whether we should teach this. Now, obviously, I don't know, again, how it works in American design schools, but here we have separate modules for employability and professional practice and things like that. Do you think there would be a space for teaching this as a distinct thing? And if so, how would you go about doing it? What part of your book, for example, would you say would be the critical thing to understand to help young designers get their heads around the possibilities of this alternative mode of practice?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, I've been invited to talk at professional practice courses from, you know, San Diego to University of Toronto. And I think it's really important to introduce the concept of, and I think it's actually gaining quite a bit of momentum right now, which in some ways I feel like this book is a little late to the table, you know, but people are talking about this, talking about alternative modes of practice. And I think, you know, professional practice, I actually learned about a cooperative as a possibility in my professional practice class. You know, it was mentioned for 2 seconds, and no one really dug into the data, but I think in my mind, it was like, oh, great. That's a model that exists. And it, you know, it was just on a list, LLC, you know, corporation, cooperative. And so for me, I was like, wow, this kind of joint ownership model is actually very values aligned to how I understand myself as a human in the world and how I want to like work with other people. And so I think it could be talked about there, but I would say even more importantly, we should be talking about democratic organizing in school, because I think that it is such an important part of society, of the world, that we're never taught how to not get what we want and how to make decisions for the collective. You know, I think in the US, sometimes we vote, sometimes we don't, and it really has no immediate impact on our life. And I mean, I think in some more local elections, it actually does. But I think, you know, the majority of Americans, you know, sometimes vote in national elections. And, you know, what do they get for that? But I think that kind of getting down to making decisions for a more immediate collective and understanding that there are benefits beyond, like there are benefits to community beyond just getting your, you know, needs met immediately, that I think we should start teaching. I don't know what that class is called, what it looks like. And I think it could be very tailored to architecture as well. But, you know, I think it's just like getting out of this individualism mindset here, and kind of community orienting ourselves, which, you know, again, applies to the workplace, applies to our communities that we're living in, you know, just has so many kind of ripples that it can exceed.
One last question. How does one start? I mean, start in a corner, obviously. What's the first move that you would advise people to take if they wanted to go the path that you've gone? And you haven't made it sound too onerous. So I think hearing this, more people will be inspired than put off. But what would be the first thing to do?
I think this is a good question, and I think that it has a lot of different answers for depending on where you are in your practice of architecture. If you know, are just wanting to start a fresh firm, then, you know, you get your co-owners together and you work with an attorney to kind of figure this out. And I will just kind of say that there's attorneys that don't really know about cooperatives and don't really know about architects, and it's kind of hard to find one that knows about both. I also, there's a lot, if you're in an office that kind of wants to transition, it's an existing office, and you kind of get enough worker buy-in, I think, you know, there's a lot of organizations that support this transition to worker ownership. There's several here in the United States. And then if you're a business owner that wants to retire and you don't really know what to do with your business, an option would be to sell it to your employees. Again, this is a transition model, and there's plenty of support organizations for that. I will also kind of say that there's a lot of hesitancy around the cooperative model, because it is, you know, I don't think every business is actually suited to be a cooperative. You can't really force this type of organizing on everyone. But I think that there are kind of phases to it, and ways that you can maybe not change your entire entity type entirely, but you can bring some of these democratic principles into your organization. I think a really good way to start would be to like talk about the firm's finances collectively, share your salary with your coworker, ask questions, you know, just kind of ask for more transparency as a worker, because with that, you really start kind of getting the conversation started.
Fantastic. That's a wonderful point to finish on. Thank you very much, Ashton.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is another way. There's always another way, if you're willing. Thanks to Ashton for the short and exceedingly sweet conversation, and for the book too. Thank you to Oro Editions for the PDF. All necessary links are in the podcast description as ever, and thanks for listening.